We have now an interesting hearing. Those hearing is open for the NGO we decided today in the morning, for José Pedro Ramos Asensao. Is he present? Ah, you, okay. Before we starting this public hearing on an anonymous donation of sperm and oocytes, balancing the rights of parents, donors, and children, let me really very warmly welcome our experts and who have kindly joined us today, traveling to Lisbon and talk with us. At the moment, we are trying to get a connection with an anonymous donor, but he is at the moment far away, and we hope to get him on phone in this hearing, but we will see. First, welcome Mrs. Carla Maria Pino Rodriguez. She is president of the National Council of Medically Assisted Procreation of Portugal. Welcome. Mr. Miguel Oliveira da Silva, he is member of the Committee on Bioethics of the Council of Europe, and he is also from Portugal. Further, Mrs. Joanna Rose and Mr. Christoph Masel, donor-conceived persons. Let's welcome both. And we will see if I can welcome also one anonymous donor. He is original French. But before we start, I want to give the floor to our rapporteur, Petra de Sutter, for a short introduction.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dear colleagues, I will be very brief because the introductory memorandum has already been discussed in committee and has been declassified. But just to set the scene, we're here today because donor anonymity, sperm and eggs, and embryos for that matter, is in Europe still very differently treated in different European countries in the legislations that we know. In the northern countries of Europe, anonymity has been completely banned, like in most Scandinavian countries, the UK and the Netherlands, but in other European countries, anonymity is still the rule. So we want to approach this issue from a human rights perspective, and as you have been reading, I guess, the problem with human rights is that they often have to be balanced against other human rights. In this case, you have the rights of the intended parents, you have the rights of the children, you have the rights of the donor. So how can we strike a balance in dealing with all these rights? And we have given some problems that go with the sperm anonymity, donor anonymity, of public health issues. Of course, the fundamental ethical issues, talking about children's rights to know their origins, and also more practical arguments regarding modern genetic technologies, which may one day make donor anonymity an illusion in itself. So how to deal with that, how to come to some text that can be accepted in this committee. And this is why we have indeed invited the experts today to enlighten us, to give their opinions on the subject. And maybe at the end of the debate, Mr. Chair, I will come back into the discussion, but I think we first have to listen and learn from our invited guests. Thank you.
Great proposal. We follow your proposal, and I really ask immediately Carla Maria to take the floor. The floor is yours.
Excelentíssimo Sr. Stefan Shenak,
Stefan Tenema, Chairperson of the Committee on Social Affairs, Health and Sustainable Development of the Council of Europe. Luis Reitramos, Vice Chair of this committee, thank you for inviting me. Petra de Sutter, who is the rapporteur for this report. Other guests, ladies and gentlemen, members of Parliament. I would like to begin by congratulating the Committee for Social Affairs, Health and Sustainable Development of the Parliamentary Assembly of the Council of Europe for its focus on this topical and very delicate issue, and Pedro Sousa, the rapporteur, for the care that she took in drawing up this report, which one hopes to be most useful. Thank you for choosing Portugal for this meeting, because currently we are passing through a difficult and complex process of radical change in our paradigm, from almost complete anonymity of the donors of gametes, which was the case up until about 5 months ago, to a situation of relative anonymity, which may be agreed to by Parliament. The law passed by Parliament of up until the 25th of April this year was for anonymity. The law provided for absolute confidentiality. There was absolute anonymity where a person was the product of medically assisted reproduction. Similarly, those individuals had no obstacle to the only obstacle which was overcome was the possibility of marrying somebody and suffering the possibility of consanguinity, but anonymity was maintained nevertheless. The result is that there is the obligation for absolute confidentiality was waived where the interest of the individual concerned prevailed. Now, on the 24th of April 2018, the Constitutional Court, the highest court, which ensures that laws abide by the Constitution of the Portuguese Republic, declared in its decision of 225 of 2018 that point one of Article 15 was unconstitutional, where it demands absolute confidentiality with relation to people who were born via medically assisted reproduction, including in a situation of substitution, and on the identity of participants as donators or substitutes, and in order to prevent the limitation on the development of people's personalities as a result of such anonymity. Anonymity was considered to be harmful to human dignity, the development of personality, and genetic identity of the individual concerned. It was concluded that anonymity did not call into question the principle of dignity of the of human person. But it did call into question the right to individual identity and development of personality. With regard to the breach of the right to personal identity, the Constitutional Court contradicted previous case law in as much as on the same question, and decision 101 of 2009, the anonymity was protected in detriment to the development of personality. Given what I've just said, in order to create a balance between the rights of parents, donors and people born via medically assisted reproduction, we are currently in a transitional phase from anonymity to non-anonymity. Until April 2018, all gamete donors were donating altruistically, freely, in confidence that their anonymity would be maintained. Up until that point, all parents who seek out medically assisted reproduction would know that the child which was born would be their own child, and they would have peace in their own family life without that being disrupted. Donors and the parents made their decisions based on fundamentals in law. With the application of this decision of the Constitutional Court, the normality of medically assisted reproduction has been seriously shaken, with the interruption, suspension, or even non-viability of treatment which was currently underway. Gametes and embryos were cryopreserved, and they could well be destroyed because the donors did not agree to continue the treatment. We needed to find a fair and balanced decision so that one does not shake completely the confidence of those people who agreed to undergo medically assisted reproduction. And of course, that concern certainly had a major effect on the decision of the donor and parents to go ahead. Now, we are currently in a transitional situation where donors who donated on the basis of anonymity have the choice whether they accept to the raising of confidentiality. Donors whose genetic material has not been used, they can now choose whether they permit or not the use of their gamete, knowing that now their confidentiality is no longer assured. It is in the hands of the MPs in this Parliament to legislate and ensure that no gamete is lost and no embryo is destroyed during this process. One hopes that this situation, this overview, which is the situation currently in Portugal, as we change from the paradigm of anonymity to non-anonymity, will be give you food for thought so that we can ensure that the rights of all are equally respected. Basic rights are in play here, which are constitutionally guaranteed, and this refers to all of the parties involved: the right of the person born using medically assisted reproduction techniques, using the donation of gametes, and their development, the development of their personality. But on the other hand, the rights of parents, creating a family, assurance of their private family life, and also the rights of the donors, their self-determination, their privacy, and the reservation of their own private family life. There are no absolute rights of some over others. There are no different degrees of human dignity. There are no hierarchies of persons. There are men and women who are infertile, who dream of forming a family, and they deeply love their child even before it's conceived. There are men and women who donate very generously, and there are children who are born from that generosity and that love. you can't have one without the other. So the rights of some cannot be more important than the rights of others. There has to be a balance and harmony which is found for both sides. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for your very, very clear wordings. And I hope the Portuguese member of the parliament will transport it to the committee in the parliament or to the plenary. Two are present, I think, at the moment. Miguel Oliveira da Silva. Can I give you the board, the floor, and you speak also from over there? Okay.
Oh, thank you so much. No, it's okay. You want to play it? In the hood? Okay, thank you so much, Mr. Chairman. Thank you so much, dear Petra, dear colleagues, dear deputies. Thank you so much. Let me present myself. I'm a gynecologist and working at a hospital in Lisbon and teacher of medical ethics at the Lisbon Faculty of Medicine. I am the Portuguese representative near the bioethic, the HBIO, in Strasbourg, in the Council of Europe. Whatever I will say, I have no conflict of interests. I don't work in any private clinic at assisted reproductive technology. Of course, I know my colleagues that work there. I do not work there. I don't have any interest in the business of assisted reproductive technology. And I will express my personal opinion, not the opinion of the HBO, of course. So, this, I'm sorry about the Eastern countries. This is the map. Portugal, since April 2018, banned the non-anonymous gameter donation. All Europe, of the north of Europe, has not anymore anonymous, except Denmark. Denmark is an exception. It is one of the paradise of the gameter exportation, with different price. When it is anonymous, is much cheaper than when it is non-anonymous. Portugal itself imports gameter from Spain and from Denmark still. But whatever it will happen, it's better I have it. Thank you so much. Thank you. Whatever will be the political decisions, whatever will be the ethical reasoning, one thing is clear since the decision of April 2018 in Portugal, the Constitutional Court decided that donor-conceivable people have the right to know their genetic identity. It means their genetic parents. To know, not for legal reasons, just for emotional reasons. And they have the right to know who are the donors, and they have the right to know if they have half-brothers and half-sisters, and how many and where they live. And the Constitutional Court decided that the right of the children, of the adolescents, is more important than the right of the new donors, not of the old donors, of the new donors, which are not anonymous anymore, and even more important than the so-called family peace, as it had been defined 9 years ago. As it was said, it's a different decision from the Constitutional Court, with a different composition, But meanwhile, 2019 and 2018, 9 years went on. And 9 years in the assisted reproductive technology is a lot. A lot of studies were done during these 9 years that I will summarize soon. And so, according to the Portuguese Constitutional Court, there is, yes, indeed, there is a hierarchy of values. There is a hierarchy of rights. And according to the Portuguese Constitutional Court, and I personally entirely agree, the rights of the children or of the adolescent donor conceived are more important than the rights of the new donors and of the new parents. But the anonymous gamete donation had been the end of anonymous gamete donation had been announced since a few years. And the end of anonymous gamete donation, whatever we think, whatever we want, is unavoidable for a very practical reason. If not for a political decision, if not for an ethical decision, as I would like, for a very pragmatic decision, and I will follow now one of the important papers of Joyce Harper, who wrote 1 year and a half ago, The End of Donor Anonymity, how genetic testing at home by internet is likely to drive anonymous gamete donation out of business. What does it mean? It means that now already, and more and more and more, over 3 million of adolescents have used direct-to-consumer genetic tests to find information about their ancestry, and many are participating in international genetic databases. This means that whether we donate in an anonymous or not country, people should be informed that anonymity is not guaranteed, and that they may be traced through their DNA. What does it mean? Adolescents at home, with genetic tests that they can import through the internet, if they have a sample of saliva, of the epithelium of the mouth or of the skin, and if they check themselves, their brother, their sister, their parents, they immediately know if, under a genetic point of view, they are really from the same origin or no. So, donor conceived who have not informed their status may find out they are donor conceived. There are a site called Donor Detectives. There is a site called 23andMe. Everybody knows. So, if not for a political reason, if not for ethical reasons, for pragmatic reasons, the genetic tests themselves at home will finish within 1, 2, 3 years with anonymity. That's obvious, no doubt about it. Okay, what is the truth? Big question from the Bible, when Pontius Pilatus asked Christ, what is the truth? Parents using donor conception should be encouraged to disclose, tell the truth, the use of gametes to their children. It would be a big philosophical discussion. Omission is a lie? I think so. Intended omission is a lie? I do think so. I know some people probably can not. So there are several questions I would like to know how to answer. Which is the percentage of parents in Portugal, for instance, in several European countries, who told their children about their genetic origins? We don't know. As far as I know, in Portugal, no study was done till today, as far as I know. It means that no one went to the children, adolescents, young adults, which were conceived by donor donation, asking them, would you like to know your genetic parents? Would you like to know if you have half brother and sisters, and then half sisters? Why such a study was never done in Portugal? Why not? Where are the psychologists, the sociologists? They are not interested in such a study? Quite strange. So, when to tell, how to tell, as early as possible, and there are a lot of studies that were done exactly
between 2009 and 2018. So when some people now say, oh, the Portuguese Constitutional Court said the opposite in 2009, of course. But meanwhile, a lot of excellent studies, not in Portugal, were done by Isaacson, Susan Gollenbach, Visser, the Nuffield Council on Bioethics, Friedman, Zade, and so on. And all the studies asked, and all the studies asked the children, do you want to know your genetic parents? And 99% said yes. At least I want to have the right to know. Then I will see. But at least I have to. I want to have the right to know. Do you want to know if you have half-brothers, half-sisters? At least I want to have the right to know it. So these studies are quite on the same way. So as Susan, as Joyce Harper said, all parties concerned must be aware that in 2016, donor anonymity does not exist anymore. I'm sorry. According to the Constitutional Portuguese Court, of course, the end of donor anonymity is not the parents' right to choose. This is something very often discussed in France. France is now with so-called état généraux de bioéthique, and quite probably in France something can change in the bioethic laws according to, as well, President Emmanuel Macron's decision. And one thing that is quite discussed in France, if they ban anonymity, because France is still anonymous, not for a long time, as I said, but it's still, they said, okay, but if children can know their parents, should their genetic parents, should the couple as well know it? That's a different question. The right of the children does not imply the right of the parents. Well, I'm going to finish my presentation in the last minute. In Portugal, as far as gamete donation is concerned, we have public and private assisted reproductive technology consultations, centers. At the National Health Service, the public, practically, gamete banks that don't exist, they are extremely reduced, absolutely tiny. So most of gamete donations exist in private clinics. It's a huge business. I have nothing against the business, if it is transparent, if it is ethical. And now, what have we seen since April? Contrary to the catastrophic and panic provisions, we see that in some private clinics, new donors are coming, probably with different social, economical characteristics. And some of the old donors, even they accept to disclose their identity. So, against the catastrophic provisions, not necessarily exists waste or loss of biological material. So, what to do with the previously obtained biological material? I agree that a transition should be implemented, but the Portuguese Parliament can make a new law. The health minister can make a new regulation. Who has the authority to do it? And, of course, we should contact previous donors. If the National Assisted Reproductive Technology Database works, some of them can be lost to follow up. Of course, new donors are coming. The new donors recruitment is showing that the market works, for sure. Business goes on, for sure. No panic, no stress. I would like that until the new law comes, and the new law will come when the Parliament wants, I would not be in a hurry, but can be approved in October if they want. I would like that now a participated, large, informed, bottom-up debate with no mediatic stress will come. I would like that not only this conference, and I congratulate you for this important initiative, but I would like that, for instance, the Portuguese Assisted Reproductive Technology Authority would have the initiative to make conference symposiums with different and plural positions. Something was not done. I would like that public and mandatory conflict of interest declarations come now, at least, at last. I don't accept, I don't agree that in the Portuguese Assisted Reproductive Technology Authority work citizens that have huge interest in private clinics. I don't accept without public and known conflict of interest declarations. I don't accept that at the Portuguese Assisted Reproductive Technology Authority works as well a member of the Portuguese Parliament. I think it's a conflict of interest. And this has, at now, at least, to be discussed. Last slide. This transition is a good, or should be, a good opportunity to better know who are the new donors, which is their social and economical profile. Once we don't know the social and economical profile of the old donors. Some people speak about true altruism. I doubt. I have doubts. When a woman receives in Portugal 843 euros per compensation, and she can receive these three times, and when this was increased 33% from 2015 to 2016, no other salary was increased 33% in Portugal from 2015 to 2016, I wonder if this is true altruism. Of course, you can say 843 euros is nothing. It depends. If you are rich, it's nothing. If you are extremely poor, it's a lot. And we don't know the social economical profile of the old donors. So for me, this is not necessarily true altruism. So we should probably rethink if donors should be paid in such an amount and how often. We should discuss how often donors can give oversight and spur. This means how many half-brothers and sisters can a Portuguese citizen have. And last but not least, I would love to have at all the level of the Council of Europe a good, reliable database with donor and donor-conceived children in order to avoid serious problems that we all know and read often. Thank you so much for your attention.
Thank you very much. There's a lot of work in front of you. Joanna and Christoph, you want to speak one by one? Or, yes? Okay, then Joanna, you have the floor.
I might get more. That's a good idea while I'm waiting.
Hello, hello.
Sorry?
Somebody's taking you to go.
we have a problem. Perhaps Mr. Masler starts while
we... Yes, because I've got a presentation.
Yes.
Yeah.
We need the stick. Mr. Masler, you take now the floor, please.
Monsieur le Président, Mesdames, Messieurs les parlementaires.
Ladies and gentlemen, can you hear me? Right. Members of Parliament, good afternoon. Well, I'm here to talk to you about something which is pretty complicated. I was conceived in 1986 through an anonymous sperm donation. And in 2008, I decided to set up an association for people in the same situation, people who'd been donor-conceived through or through an oocyte or gamete donation. There's one thing which I think hasn't been said so far, which I think is important before we get into the nitty-gritty of the debate. Now, we're talking about anonymity, but if you're talking about anonymity for someone who has been donor-conceived, that would assume you know how you've been conceived. Now, if I take the French case, since the beginning of the 70s, we think that about 70,000 children are gamete donor conceived, and you've got a few of those who've actually come out and said so and talked in public about this, but we don't know how many children have been informed about how they were conceived. So I think the first thing is to raise awareness on how you might have been conceived so that people who have been donor conceived can then be informed about anonymity. Now, anonymity has been waived in other EU countries. Is that as a result of a wide consultation of donor-conceived people, or is it just the product of a form of lobbying on the part of various people who wanted to reverse anonymity, which, of course, at least in France, would upset everybody and would upset this whole idea of it being free and anonymous as it is at the moment. Now, as a donor-conceived person, I'm reassured to hear that at the time my donor gave his sperm totally voluntarily. Nobody pushed him into it. He also donated in a disinterested way. There was no money involved. And when I see, for example, a sperm bank, Krios International in Denmark, where you can go and look at the donor profile and choose an anonymous or non-anonymous donor, and you can basically look at a catalogue, that prospect for me is very worrying indeed. I'm very much reassured to have been conceived through a donor who was not paid for the donation. Now, this principle of anonymity, well, I think you can't start from the idea that necessarily it would raise emotional problems, as has been said today, in donor-conceived people, because if you don't know how you were conceived, then you don't go into a campaign to smash the idea of anonymity. There are all sorts of questions that come to you. Why did my parents have to have recourse to this technique? How will that affect my development? Personally, the question of anonymity is something that occurred to me a lot later on, and it was only afterwards when I started to speak to people about this, which was not something that was easy at all, because I'm saying to you now that I am a donor sperm conceived child. At the same time, you would assume that my father was sterile or infertile. So it is complicated because I'm revealing a secret to you in doing that. Now, in the association that I am president of, there are various hundreds of children who also were reproduced through assisted reproductive technologies, and there is a minority of people who wanted to see anonymity waived. So what we've seen is that if you ask questions about how you were conceived, well, that's one thing. But reducing that question just to the idea of anonymity is something else again. Say you do ask questions, which is very human. Does that mean that your emotional difficulties, your relational difficulties, derive from the fact that your biological father was anonymous? I mean, when you're a teenager, you would have all sorts of questions coming into your head. And if I know who the donor is, then I think, oh, I might be able to have some indication as to whether it was a doctor, in which case I might think, oh, I might want to study medicine and follow in my father's footsteps. Perhaps this might be a minority view in this room, but I think the debate today should be more about the society in which we want to live. Do we want a society where everything is genetic and concentrating on individual freedoms on the basis of general interest? In France, sperm banks are still publicly owned. They're in the public sector. It's not a commercial matter. And yet there is a massive pressure going on, lobbying, to cast aside this monopoly so that the private sector could pick up these activities of ART with third-party donors. Now, to be quite honest with you, I am very pleased to be a child who hasn't got the possibility now of getting any information on who the donor was. I have learned to build my personality on that basis. I have one single father. I wouldn't talk about a biological father. Such a thing doesn't exist, because if you talk about a father, it's somebody who has a parental function in your life. So a biological father doesn't really exist. That's just a donor. Nor can you talk about half sisters or half brothers. What would that mean? That's just other people who happen to have been created by the donor who might share some of our genetic heritage. My brother, who's 2 years younger than me, came from another donor. And I asked him the question one day. I said, why don't you join our association? And what do you think about the anonymity question? And he said, I don't know. My dad is my dad. And really, that said it all. As far as he was concerned, the question of the transmission of values, upbringing, emotional and material security that a mother and father can give to their child, all that is so much more important than the genetic origin. When you talk about genetic origin, which is a big question as well, I think all of us come from many generations. Obviously, there are many generations behind us and many ahead of us, so we don't know everything about our genetic origins. Genetic tests don't just relate to donor-conceived children. Even you, created in the old way, as it were, you can have a genetic test as well. And the problem I also have with regard to these genetic tests is that, let's say I want to get round the French system now, and therefore I buy the genetic test, I have a look at the database, nothing is there to tell me that my donor is still alive. I don't know, maybe the donor's died. I really don't know. Has the donor himself had any genetic tests? Has he made any approaches? Why would he do that? And then what are the consequences? Once I've identified the donor, how would I get in touch with him? Maybe there is a third way forward that we haven't really looked at, between completely waiving the anonymity and clamping down and keeping anonymity. And we've discussed this in the association, and this is about access to data which are not identifying. In other words, information which wouldn't allow you directly to get in touch with the donor, but they would be factors that would allow us to know a few things about the donor. their reasoning, their motive, their age, perhaps even the number of children the person had in his family, not necessarily the genetic half-sisters and brothers, what job he did. But again, if you go down that third road, you still have to ask what kind of data would you pass on and what is the importance of those data for the donor-conceived child? Could you make a hierarchy of them? And if you draw up a list, why would you stop at 10 criteria, not 15 or 7? So I think, speaking as a donor-conceived person in France, I'm attached to this idea that it should be voluntary and anonymous and free. I can say to you, speaking for the people who belong to our association, that there wouldn't be a majority of children who are in emotional distress because of how they've been conceived. They came to the association because they were asking questions about this rather odd way of being conceived. The question of anonymity is something for everybody to take a position on. But I think since you've got 70,000 births since the 70s in France, we don't really have enough people to make a judgment on the anonymity question. What bothers people who are most bothered by the anonymity aspect is the lucrative private commercial aspect of it. The fact that the market wants to pick up something which at the moment is in the public domain, public sector. So I don't think you should speak for donor-conceived people. You need to listen to them, not assume what they think, and don't rush into this. It doesn't bother me that France be an island sticking to this system, because if you think that in France anonymity isn't a problem, it's true some people will try and go round the system and go abroad, but this happens with other countries. In sperm banks, such as the one in Denmark, it's already possible to get round the system. And there are people in the association who are the fruit of sperm coming from Denmark because the parents wanted an identified donor. So there's always a way of getting round the legislation. And parents that don't want to have a child who can find the donor will choose an anonymous donor or not tell the child how they were conceived anyway. Thank you very much.
Thank you so very much. Now, I don't know what is with the telephone, but now I give to Mrs. Rose.
Just check I can move this forwards and backwards, okay. Hello. Thank you all for the chance to speak. And the reason why I'm here today and the reason why I did my PhD is because I was frustrated in my early 20s about the fact that I was donor conceived and there were lots of experts speaking about us without us. So I did a PhD on this topic, so I'm now Dr. Joanna Rose, and I had a human rights test case in England. I'd love to tell you more about my PhD if I had more time, but basically I was looking at also other situations in our history where people were denied knowledge of who they were related to as a matter of government policy. And I really challenge everybody here to think of any group in society throughout history who was intentionally denied knowledge about who they were related to. In the long run, there is always a backlash against that policy, and there's always a substantial amount of people who express considerable anguish and the lifelong pain from that. So I would disagree with the fellow donor offspring and say that I personally know of people around the world who, on their own, without funding, are doing court cases, PhDs. They're making car bumper stickers saying genetic matter matters. There's badges saying donor conception equals genetic conception. There's books called Anonymous Us, written by Donor Offspring. There's websites, there's YouTube channels. We're rising up as a strong force. We're not a small bunch. But even if we were, a bit like the women who wanted to have a vote. There were a lot of women at the time who didn't want to have the vote. But my question to you is, what percentage of us should express anguish at not knowing who we're related to, what our medical history is, and what our ethnicity is, before that's something that affects your decision-making? What percentage? How many have to be hurt? If you go by the principle that all swans are white, I'm the black swan here in front of you. So if you make a decision that in any way supports donor anonymity, you need to accept that you're complicit in the future, I would say, emotional torture of various people. And I'm not saying those strong words lightly. I know numerous donor offspring that feel that way and have spent their lives trying to express that. So I went to my government in my 20s. I went to the HFEA, and nobody's interested. So when people would say, look, there's loads of people that are conceived that way, and we don't know about how many people are hurt, well, that's because there's nowhere for us to go. We all get sent away. Deal with it yourself. Pay for your private counselling. But eventually, I had a High Court test case in England, and a judicial review judgment, established the right to know your identity is integral to respect for private and family life, found in Article 8. Mr. Justice Scott Baker also ruled that a donor offspring's information about the biological parent goes to the very heart of their identity and makeup as people, and that an AID child is entitled to establish a picture of his or her identity as much as anyone else. And anonymous donation was banned in the UK, and I'm very happy about that. Having said that, there's all sorts of loopholes. So, as I was saying, there's various donor offspring around the world. Despite the fact that we've got nowhere to go, we've got no point of place to go to say, we've got a problem, can you register this? Like, often you go into public toilets in England and they say, how do you feel about this service? Happy, not happy, sad. I'd like to press a button, you know, and there's plenty of us who would like to say, press the button, not happy about this practice. So this is another person, one of my best friends called Noelle Geish, who we campaigned together in Australia for 15 years. She spent 15 years trying to find out who her genetic father was and who her genetic siblings were. She was raised in a Maltese family. She wanted to know if she was genetically Maltese. Now, whilst she was campaigning, she got to meet her genetic father, who, funnily enough, was delighted to meet her and was very disturbed that she'd spent 15 years trying to track him down and had been met by all these legislative barriers. And he's a member of an organization called MAD, which is Men Against Anonymous Donation. There are also plenty of men who, in high insight, realized that actually, when they were told that they had no moral responsibility for their children if they donated sperm, realized in retrospect, actually, I do care about how these children are. If they've got some questions to ask, I want to be able to answer them. And actually, I've got some questions too. And actually, he was a very loving father to her. Not her social father, so she has two fathers, social father and a genetic father. But the reason why Narelle was allowed to meet her genetic father was because during her campaigning, she had trouble with her tummy, and they thought this was irritable bowel syndrome. But actually, it was a genetic cancer. And they only discovered this when they found out it was stage 4 bowel cancer. And because she'd been prominent in parliamentary debates, the Governor General overturned anonymity and found her father for her 6 weeks before she died. Had she not been dying, they wouldn't have let her. But look how happy he is to meet her. So she died. She had 8 siblings, unknown siblings in other families who were all predisposed to the same genetic cancer. There was no way of letting them know that they were predisposed to that. And they could have had screening and potentially found treatment to prevent early death. So when Parliamentarians were aware of her plight. They saw her die. They knew of her siblings. There was a law created in her honour called Norell's Law, which overturned donor conception anonymity retrospectively. People might be surprised about that, but anonymity in adoption in the UK was overturned retrospectively in 1975. So in most situations where you find that the best interest of the child has in some ways been compromised, that eventually is overturned in favour of the rights of the child. So the reasons for this law was that there was a recognition for at least some people, while some people might not want that information for their identity, there's enough of us that do. That there's a need to have updated and consistent medical history, and that that can even prevent early death. Consanguineous relationships. Lots of people donate. There's lots of donations in small geographic areas, in similar social groups, and there's a high likelihood of genetic sexual attraction, where children who are related to each other, siblings, don't know, and they end up having children together. It's a well-recognized phenomenon in adoption called genetic sexual attraction. We're actually really quite likely to be attracted to somebody that you're genetically related to if you don't know you're genetically related to them. So it's very common in adoption. It's understood. Issues of openness, honesty, and equality. That was recognized as important. Obviously, the opposite of that is that laws represent dishonesty, lack of transparency, and a lack of equality, inequality. I would argue that that's what anonymous donation does. So what we have now is different treatment for different people who are produced in different batches around the world, even in different geographic locations. Depends on when you were conceived, where you were conceived, as to what rights you have. But the new law came into force, Norell's Law, in March 2017, and provides children, people with the right to pass information backwards and forwards and meet each other. You can't contact or harass a genetic parent against their consent, but you can know who they are. If they want contact with you, then you can have contact. But if you did pursue that issue and harass them, you'd be fined and potentially have a prison sentence. So that comes to the issue of birth certification. I was really struck when I registered my children for their birth certificates that it said it was fraudulent to put, obviously, non-genetic parents on the birth certificates is actually legally fraudulent. For me, for example, to just put my best friend as a father. So we live in a society where the genetic truth is what is expected to be placed on birth certificates, and we rely on people and governments to represent that principle, to protect that principle. But yet donor offspring are the only people in society today that actually are intentionally deceived about who they're related to, what their medical history is, what their ethnicity is, basic human rights. And this is another donor offspring, Emma Creswell, who won a 6-year legal battle because she felt so strongly about that issue. And she had her birth certificate overturned and blanks placed where father was because she said, it is the truth, it's who I am. I questioned myself as to who I was. I thought I was one person for so long, and then I found out that the whole side of who I was wasn't true. So I changed my name to represent who I actually was. And there's a campaign called the Birth Registration Campaign that argues that the current system breaches children's rights to family life because they can't contact their genetic family or have their human rights recognized, like was in my court case, unless their social parents choose to tell them they're donor conceived. You can be born from embryo adoption and have a misleading birth certificate, which is fortified by law. But if you're an adoptee, then you have a birth certificate that will tell you that. So clearly, equality is not taking place at the moment. And it's important that our governments protect those future generations from this type of deception. But at the moment, what we have, I think it was great points about how ultimately there's really serious interest at stake here, particularly in terms of stakeholder interests and a lot of money at stake. So at the moment we have the infertility industry, which either seeks no regulation, they say this is a private matter, stay out of the bedrooms, or they say, look, this is so complex and so emotionally vexed, you have to let us run the show. So they seek to regulate themselves. For example, in England, we have an organization called the HFEA, which is a committee that polices reproductive technology, but it's comprised of up to 50% industry providers, and then the other stakeholders are the infertile and the pro-cloning and the embryo research advocates. Not one single known donor or donor offspring is on that committee or has ever been on that committee. I applied to go on the committee 10 years ago, and they said they, quote, didn't think I'd make a good team player. So you know what team they want. So this is an inappropriate representation. It's not appropriate in terms of representing those trained in the best interest of the child or the welfare of the child. There's very few people who are trained in that, even on the committees. And they're unelected and they're unrepresentative of even all the stakeholders. Eventually, I got them to recognize that donor offspring are indeed stakeholders. But yet, none of us are on their committee, and never have been. So there's a bias towards the industry, and they are very resistant to responsibility for or input from adult donor offspring born pre-1991. What I've certainly witnessed is that for donor offspring that come forward and say, look, I felt really wanted and loved, I'm really happy, I don't need any information about where I come from, they're considered well-balanced. And they're pushed forward on a pedestal as well-balanced spokespeople by either infertility support groups or by the industry themselves or by both. And they're given opportunities to present in front of committees like this. But those people that say that there's a really serious problem here generally don't get that position to state what the problem is and why. So the industry itself isn't learning from its own mistakes because it's got this underbelly which is suppressed and oppressed. I had to do a PhD. I had to do a court case and win it to be here today. So what I watch in my PhD, I watched this. I'm dyslexic, so doing a PhD was really hard, but it took me 7 years. And in that time, I was looking at what's going on legally. Normally, the best interest of the child is considered paramount. I'm looking at international human rights law, and it's, hold on, the best interest of the child is paramount. And where there's a conflict of interests, normally, the best interests of the child prevail. That's normal in law. But in this situation of donor conception, the welfare of the child gets defined by those interested parties that have a conflict of interests. They define the welfare of the child on what principles? It becomes very handy-bendy. So in these practices that involve children, it's usual law, the state supports the idea that best interests of the child are paramount, and they have special protection owing to their vulnerability. But in our case, the rights of the child to their natural family, to have our rights recognized to our natural family, has become overturned. Previously, over the last 50 years, normally law was set in place, human rights law was set in place to protect a child's right to be known and raised by their genetic family. And the state should only interfere with that if the child was at risk of harm. But now, what's happening with law is that the law is being used to discard your genetic family and to contract and fortify a social family. Now, for some, that's fine. But for others, that's not. What happens is that instead of the best interest of the child, as a legal term, you get some slippery words coming into place. And it was the HFEA that was encouraging words like the health and well-being of children. Or in Ireland, there's laws that are being introduced where welfare is taken into consideration as far as practicable. So here we go. Where are we going? What are the best interests of the child? Is it the stakeholders who decide that? It's a buyer's market. So don't forget in this buyer's market that the fertility industry profit is worth nearly $5 billion, projected to be worth nearly $5 billion by 2025. So it's a sizable industry with commercial sperm banks, a crucial and profitable part of it. There's a global sperm bank business that could be worth nearly $5 billion. And this legislative Swiss cheese represents opportunity for trade. So in the UK, I'm sure the HFEA is really happy about the fact that there's still a smoker's board of options. You can go to a clinic, you can say, look, I want anonymous donation, and the fact that I won a court case that said it's a human right not to have anonymous donation is irrelevant, because that clinic will offer a service to assist a clinic in Spain or wherever, and actually help them on the way to go and have that anonymous donation if they want it. So this... Now, the consequence of this, these are my children. Now, my son has had a heart monitor for 48 hours a couple of weekends ago. My daughter was tested, is continually being tested for diabetes. And each time I go to the GP, they say, do you have a family history of this? And I say, I don't know. And actually, the people in charge at the time of considering my interests and my children's interests are responsible for that. They are responsible for the early death of Narelle Geesh. There's somebody called Alison Davenport who died from my clinic, Harley Street in London. They're responsible because they were complicit in deception on their birth certificates, complicit in fortifying law that didn't allow them to know who they were related to. So my children are aware that they're in this position where they don't know, you know, I was raised in a Jewish family. My social family is Jewish. So we have all these celebrations about what ancestors were doing 2,000 years ago, and we'd be copying, mimicking what they're doing of breaking bread, drinking wine. But now I'm in a situation where I have, that's not my ancestry, and that's not my children's. But all I can tell them is, we don't know. I don't know. I don't know if you're Irish. We listen to music, and my son says, are we Irish? Are we? I said, I don't know. And he already, my son, is ready to fight. You know, it's not just me. It's not just me. There's intergenerational consequences. So in conclusion, we need a paradigm shift from reproductive technology, from it being an adult-centric treatment, to applying normative standards for protecting the best interests of the child. You know, we have adoption policy. We have all sorts of policies in our laws that recognize what the best interests of the child are. We've got all sorts of experts that understand what the best interests of the child are. And those experts aren't gynecologists. So gynecologists are experts at gynecology. So we need to address this stakeholder representation imbalance. Make it visible. Absolutely. Make visible. What are your interests? What's your position in this? How many of the researchers are adoptive parents who have a vested interest in saying that genetic genes don't matter? So many of them are. So we need multidisciplinary protections to counter the conflict of interest from the infertility industry and its users. We need to acknowledge this is a social experiment, and we need a central point for accountability and responsivity to those adversely affected. This was a social experiment on me. I had no choice. But what happens when you do a social experiment on somebody and then they say, stop, that hurts, that's not good for me, can you stop? Because that's what happened to me when I was in my 20s. I said, stop, that hurts. And nobody did anything. So there's no, for the people, when you actually do this, there is no interest in slowing down the juggernaut. It's like, we're off, it's already happening. You know, no time to talk. Get over it, pay for your counseling. No, if you're doing a social experiment, take responsibility, listen to the people who are hurt, respond to that, and respond to that with financing, support services, apologies. apologise to those people, not just the people who are dead because they didn't know their medical history, but the people who spend their lives trying to find out, like me, who their first-degree genetic relative is. Who's my father? I'd like an apology. I've seen the Stolen Generations get apologies. I've seen adoptees get apologies. We're next. So, reparations and services to help address the adverse consequences created for donor offspring. We need records saved. People are destroying our records all the time. When I talk to other donor offspring and they contact the clinics, there's always been a fire, an office fire. In my case, in my court case, the gynecologist said there was a flood, a fire, and my records were placed on a tip. So we need somebody to go in there and protect our records now. Support services, specialized counseling services, probably based in the same way as adoption, where you have that knowledge of the consequences of genetic rupture. And most of all, the point of international human rights law, I think, is to respect equality for everybody, for the genetic kinship and identity of all groups of society. If you're going to pay for and fund and empathize with infertility and the services that help people become genetic parents by providing sperm washing, ICSI, IVF, you're recognizing that those people want to have their own genetic child.
I'm sorry.
We need the same principles applied to us. We need to know who our own genetic family is. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sorry, because we... We got just now the connection, fine, the Middle East to Uzbekistan, and now Tanya will call with the anonymous donor. He wants to tell us.
Oui, bonjour. Vous pouvez parler maintenant? Allô?
The interpreters will attempt to interpret this if it's... intelligible to us. We have no idea what the sound will be like. If it is not intelligible, we unfortunately will not be able to interpret. Could you talk now, sir? The committee is listening to you. Do you have any questions, or do you want me to speak? Yes, would you like to just speak now? It'll be easier.
Le jeune homme est Arthur, le fils biologique, ce sera plus simple pour la communication. Donc, moi j'ai donné des gamètes.
The interpreters apologize, but the sound is far too bad for us to be able to interpret. Our apologies.
Initiative du professeur Léon Schoenberg. J'ai donné, je crois, trois ou quatre fois. Toujours dans l'anonymat total. Tout le monde m'entend là, c'est bon ou pas du tout?
Un moment s'il vous plaît, on va juste regarder pour l'interprétation. Un moment s'il vous plaît.
Oui.
They cannot translate.
They cannot translate.
They cannot translate.
No. They said they not understand. The...
Vous pouvez continuer, on va essayer au moins.
Well, if you'd like to continue, we will try to answer. Does the committee have any questions that would like to ask? How has your experience been?
Ça va être difficile parce que j'ai déjà été confronté à ce genre d'interview et je préfère mais qui pose des questions, ça sera beaucoup plus rationnel pour moi parce que là je vais pas vous expliquer, je vais pas en faire un roman. S'il y a cette commission, elle a des questions précises à poser, ça sera, je pense que ça sera quand même plus rationnel pour tout le monde.
The speaker appears to be saying that it will be easier for him to speak if the committee has some specific questions for him, but I, as interpreters, I would not guarantee that that is what I heard.
Yeah. Quelqu'un veut poser une question? Un autre donneur.
Oui.
Madame de Temmerman.
Would any of you like to ask a question of the donor? Good afternoon. I don't know if you can hear me. Good morning. Afternoon. I'm a French MP. I'm a child born of ART. I'm a little bit ill, and I'm losing my voice, but I want to know if you've had any contact with children who have been born from your donation.
D'accord. Donc, Arthur, c'est un enfant issu de ce don qui aurait pris contact avec vous, c'est ça?
Arthur was a contact. Did he get into touch with you? Did it go well? Did you want that person to contact you?
C'est trop caché. Je comprends pas la moitié de vos paroles.
The speaker was saying he can't actually hear the questioner. She would like to know whether things went well when Arthur contacted you. He contacted me by writing to a neighbour. He was very careful. I received the mail in 2017, and I understood what the desire was. And my first question was how this young man had actually managed to find me. And he wanted to know whether we could meet. And so I agreed that we should meet at on the 25th of December 2017. We communicated regularly after that. And then we met. It was a very emotional moment, in fact. I believe the speaker also said that he was delighted to receive the call, but I can't be sure. So you didn't regret the fact that your anonymity was lifted and you were delighted to meet Arthur? No, I don't regret it at all. I don't regret anything. And if other children came knocking at my door, I would open my door in the same way as I have done to Arthur. But one needs to be careful. I think you need to be careful about lifting anonymity, because I dare say that there are some children who won't want to know who their biological father is, but others will. They want to find that donor, and it depends on whether the donor is happy with this anonymity being raised or lifted, and it's up to you to decide whether that is the correct thing.
Bonjour, monsieur. Je suis Petr.
Good morning. Good afternoon. I am Petr de Souter. I'm a rapporteur for the Council of Europe. My question is today, given the situation, would you be prepared to be a donor without anonymity? Would you be prepared to do it? Or going back to when you were a donor, would you have been prepared to be a donor if you weren't anonymous? So I'm looking at this from the point of view of the donor. Did you hear my question? No. Perhaps I should repeat the question then. Madame de Souter from Belgium, our rapporteur, she wanted to know whether today anonymity had been lifted, you would be prepared to give sperm today, or whether in 1974, whether your donation, you only were a donor because of anonymity, that was important to your decision. Could you please repeat the question once again, says the speaker. Madame de Souter wanted to know if you would have donated your sperm in 74 if you were not guaranteed anonymity at the time. I do apologize, but I couldn't hear the question, says the speaker. I do apologize, but I simply can't hear the question. But okay, well, thank you very much, nevertheless, for having agreed to speak with us. I think we need to bring things to an end here because the connection is very bad. I'm very, very sad about that. Because I want the Council of Europe to do something to lift the anonymity. For Arthur, it was very important in searching his roots. It meant a lot to him. We're not now back in 1974, we're in a new century, and circumstances have changed. I'm very sad that I can't answer you because I can't really hear your questions. But but if you would like to contact me through Arthur, I promise that I will answer you. I wish you the best for the rest of your working day. Thank you very much. Much of that was lost, unfortunately. The interpreters apologize, but perhaps half of it was unintelligible.
He's on mission in Uzbekistan at the moment, so I think the Council of Europe is going to kill us because it's cost a bomb, but no, we'll see.
But we tried the best, and it's interesting to listen to somebody who is who was an anonymous donor. He came in contact with one of 19 child. 19? I think I heard 19. Maybe it was a misunderstanding. And we heard also that he applied to the Council of Europe to come to an end with the anonymous regulation. Now, I want to look to you. Any comments to our interesting hearing from your side? Are you still in the mind of the Uzbekistan call? Mr. Mullen, please.
Thank you, Stefan. This is no small issue, and congratulations to Petra de Souter for, I think, bringing together such a varied panel who I think are bringing out for us just how troubling and complex this issue can be and is. I couldn't help thinking of Sir Walter Scott's famous quotation, but it has to be adapted slightly, which is, "Oh, what a tangled web we weave when once we practice to, shall we say, conceive," because there is enormous complexity in this issue. And it strikes me that there is a prior question here that we all should ask, and which perhaps each of our member states needs to ask, which is, does a child have a prior right over adults' unmet need to parent? Because I think on the answer to that question will hinge the direction that we will want to go with our respective policies. If a child has some kind of a prior right, as was brought out by one of the Portuguese speakers in the context of the Portuguese Constitutional Court decision, well, then we ask, where does that right begin? Is it the right not to have your genetic parenting sundered from your gestation and your social parenting? Have you a right to a unity in the identity of your genetic and your social parent? That would certainly be my point of view. I recognise that it wouldn't be everybody's point of view. But I would ask that in some way the existence of that fundamental question be brought out in the report, because it is determinative of so much of what follows. If one takes the view that then within the majority of countries where this is happening, so where you have donor-conceived parenting, what then does the child's right involve? If you were to take the very different presentations of Christoph and Joanna, and we must be very grateful, I think, to both of them speaking so authoritatively from their personal experience. Well, the question that occurred to me was, does a person have a right to be told whether they are donor conceived? And I think the only way we could integrate the, I think what would be the very different responses of Christoph and Joanna would seem to be that the answer seems to be, yes, you do have the right to be told, but only if you ask. And that's the kind of complexity we're in. And I also think that it isn't enough to just consider the question of whether a person might be adversely affected by the phenomenon of anonymous donor conception. I think there is the question of rights, whether one has a right to know, regardless of whether one is adversely affected by suffering from the anonymity of that relationship and the potential stresses that might arise in some cases. Final question. Surely with science, and so much social science, is telling us about the importance of fathers these days. Don't we need to be considering linking men back to their responsibilities? And doesn't that involve asking the question of whether they should have responsibility for what happens to their gametes? A question that we haven't yet considered, but perhaps we ought. Should somebody who donates, and by definition it couldn't be anonymous, should they have some obligation to provide for a child into the future? Supposing a child is brought up by a very poor family and they discover that their donor parent actually has a lot of the good things of this world. Some of us might think that there ought to be some responsibility that goes with that. Again, it's a question that I think we have to grapple with in the context of the report. And I wish you well with it, because it is a very complex and troubling issue.
Thank you very much. Please, Madame Estrela.
Thank you, Chair. I'd like to thank all of the speakers. Very interesting. I believe that this has been very useful as a debate, although I've ended up with more doubts than certainties. But as a member of the Portuguese Parliament, I have to have something to say, and I have to take a stance. I don't have one at the moment. I'm very divided. I have very contradictory feelings. I face a difficulty of how we can come up with legislation that is fair, balanced, that takes into account the contradictory interests of the child, the donor, the families, so all stakeholders. That is where the difficulty lies. Of course, I don't deny that genetics is an important issue. It's important for the identity of the child as an individual. But at the same time, one has to take into account the fact that this person who is born from sperm through an ART process, because somebody who was infertile and who wanted to have a son or daughter. this is a very weighty issue as well. If we compare these situations with adoption situations, with all of the problems that have been raised because there was the there existed the anonymity of the person who gave the child for adoption, and the issue of whether the child should know his or her biological family. I have a question for myself, but I would like to hear the views of specialists who have studied this issue, which I haven't done. I don't understand this, know this issue very well. For example, could we not only accept donors who are registered with respect to their health certificate, if you like, so that we can have a guarantee that they are healthy donors? The same as blood donors have to be healthy. A number of different requirements exist. But I know that this type of issue does raise a number of different questions and doubts amongst those people who don't have any certainty.
So?
Merci à tous nos orateurs pour.
Thank you to all our speakers for their multifaceted presentations and viewpoints. It's very interesting for you, for us. One issue which we are understanding by listening to Christophe and speaking to my colleague, I understood the same thing. Christophe said that there are 70,000 children born of gamete to donations, but we're talking about children's rights, knowing their genetic heritage and so forth. But I wonder, of those 70,000, there are many parents who haven't told anything to their children. And so what do we do there? Sometimes the child only knows when they're 18, 20 years old, and it can be a complete catastrophe. And so, of course, one has to bear in mind the interests of those individuals, because you have to bear in mind the damage that that could cause when this fact is revealed so much later in a person's life.
Thank you, Jolant. Now, Franz Essel.
Danke, Herr Präsidenter. Ich glaube,
thank you very much, Chairman. I think one of the previous speakers did mention this thing, that there are methods where everybody can research at home where they came from and whether they are actually related to the parents they've grown up with or not. So I think anonymity is surely a very important issue, and we should say right at the beginning what the reality is. The only trouble is that, of course, sometimes with natural insemination, the wrong father is there as well, and you don't know. But basically, it is possible for someone to check anyway. Now, if we talk about the right of the child and that being prevalent, more important than the right of the donor and the rights of the parents, then I think here you should be logical and say, as of when does that right prevail? The right of the child, is it from the moment it's born, or is it even earlier when it's even in the womb? I think this is something that we also need to discuss.
Thank you. And now the last to ask for the floor is Martin Mergen.
Thank you. I'll be brief. Congratulations to Petra for bringing this to the panel. This has been a very emotional subject, and it can show the finer points of the issue. A number of questions. Mr. De Silva, you talked about the change of the law in Portugal. I think in future, donors, they will no longer be anonymous. But looking into the past, donors who have given their sperm or their oocytes or their embryos in the past, can you guarantee that they are going to remain anonymous? I wonder whether you should make this distinction, despite these home genetic tests, a distinction between those who donated when they were guaranteed on anonymity under the law, and another situation for people who are concerned directly. I think that parents need to be able to need to have to say to their children that they are donor conceived, but I need to know when, at what stage of a life should parents actually tell their children that they are donor conceived.
Impression may be like by adoption. One day is the day coming where you have to speak with your children. Anne from Finland, and after I have Stella from Cyprus. Is there anybody else who asks for the floor? Mr. Oehme from Germany, and you too? You ask for the floor? Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you.
Chair, in Finland, identity of the donors has been registered since 2007, so I support this same thing for other countries. And in Finland, there's a system when children is 18 years old, she or he has possibility to get to know who is her or his father. But there was one thing that happens afterwards when we had that legislation. It was that the donors amount dropped dramatically. So afterwards it has gone up a bit or quite much. But I think we have to recognize this thing and do something to ensure that there will be enough donors afterwards as well.
Stella.
First of all, I want to thank everyone on the panel for their excellent presentations, and thank Petra for once again bringing before us questions and reports that make us move one step ahead to where we think we are. And I think that's the challenge of being part of the Parliamentary Assembly. I'll be very brief. I think we're facing new realities in the area of donor conception, and we're having to readjust our paradigms in the way we think. We're not always all going to agree about how we should proceed, but I just want to think that I want to say that children's rights should be held as uppermost, and children have the right to know. And I remember as a child psychologist many years ago when, even in the cases of adoption, it was considered extremely difficult for parents to tell their children they were adopted. Now, the large majority of parents know that they're expected to tell their children that they're adopted. Then we were asked, when should I tell my child it's adopted? Now we are able to advise on that as well. So this is a huge paradigm shift. And just as in the case of adopted children, when they have the right to know, and parents should be encouraged to reveal, this is also the case of donor conception. And I think that for myself, I didn't know, I saw in the map, if I understood correctly, that the majority of European countries have waived anonymity. I just wanted to clarify that this is what I saw, and I think that's a huge step in the right direction. Thank you.
Okay, Mr. Öme, you are the last one now.
Ja, vielen Dank.
Yes, thank you very much for these presentations, which have really left me in some doubt. On the one hand, what we have to think about is the rights of the child and their right to know where they come from. In my family, I do have such a case indeed, which has drawn out over 60 years, the ramifications of it. But on the other hand, we have the rights of the anonymous donor. And as we heard from those who spoke, the question of genetic diseases or propensities to conditions. And it's very difficult for us to decide on this. And it's very difficult indeed. I think everybody has to look to their own country to see what the legal situation is.
Last one, I have an expert, Madame Frith, in the last row. Thank you. You have the floor.
Okay, so thank you very much for allowing me to speak. I'll be brief. I've conducted research in this area for a number of years, and I think it is an incredibly complicated issue as it touches on families, genetics, and the things most dear to us. As you heard, in the UK, we removed anonymity in 2005, and we didn't make it retrospective. So going forward, any donors who chose to register did that under conditions of non-anonymity. So in that sense, that's one way of getting around the difficulties of people being asked to be donors and having to re-consent. I mean, they can re-register now as non-anonymous donors. Victoria in Australia has made it retrospective. So I think there's lots of different issues to tease out here, and you can be in favour of anonymity going forward, but not necessarily want it to be retrospective. And that respects the rights of the donors, because the donors can then choose how they wish to donate. Of course, donor-conceived children don't have any choice of what situation they are born in, whereas the adults involved in these procedures, if they feel very strongly that they don't agree with non-anonymity, can choose not to undergo them. And I think the other issue to stress is that, as Joyce Harper has mentioned, it is correct that it is very difficult to maintain anonymity now. But from the research I've done with donor-conceived adults, people who are my age, before the advent of genetic testing and so on, quite often secrets came out in family rows, people disagreeing, and therefore I think it's often very hard to maintain anonymity, even if you set out to do that. So I think I'd say that I think now we're moving towards a situation where donor conception is much more socially accepted. There's no reason to keep it secret. It's not shameful. And as a society, we become more open, and that as we are about adoption, and we become more able to tell, and it's no longer such an issue. It's just one way of forming a family. And this is what these techniques do. They form families, and as Joe mentioned, donor-conceived people have children, and they form, you know, long families across the life course. So we need to be aware of that. So thank you for your discussion.
Thank you to Christoph. The figure you named with 70,000, is this only in France, or it's a European figure that maybe it's also interesting. So can I give now back to our experts? Do you want to start with answers, or you want to start? Okay, then you start, Christoph.
Well, a lot of things have been mentioned. which I'd like to come back to, because basically these are things which we hear over and over again, and they tend to be assumed that, taken on board as truths. Now, I want to talk to you first about the illness, the diseases issue. In France, the Spermatozoid Association, the equivalent of the HFEA, brings in the sperm donors and asks questions in the clinic. Have you had diabetes in your family? Have you had any heart problems in your family? And so on. One donor in two, sometimes more, are turned away by these sperm donor centres. So they don't take any risk. If there's any doubt, the donor is sent away. So for the donors who are selected, their medical dossier is clean, completely clean, by definition. So this is a false problem, the genetic diseases, which has been brought forward by people who want to waive and see a waiver of anonymity. Now, of course, I go to my GP. He will ask me, oh, is there any history of this in your family? And you can say no, because if there had been any genetic cancer problems or diabetes, that sperm donor wouldn't have been let through. So it's a false problem. They have a clean medical record, and this is something which has been assumed to be a truth for decades, whereas, in fact, one out of every two donors is sent away. Would you think doctors would even take the risk of having children born who would then develop these genetic diseases? Now, since we got quite emotional here with the donor-conceived person who had a genetic disease. Now, I have a pacemaker. I have a pacemaker which keeps me alive, so I do have a health problem. Now, after looking at this, talking about it with my family, we found that it came from my mother. So every time you take a decision to create a child, you're transmitting something to that child. You're transmitting genes, the genetic makeup, you're transmitting that. So you pass everything on to your children. And every time you do that, it's a risk. You might pass on a disease to your child. Statistically, donor-conceived people have less chance of having genetic cancer because all the donors are screened. I was unlucky because I developed diabetes because the donors would normally be rejected, and it depends on whether it's a type 1 or type 2, but one cannot be transmitted. I could develop diabetes if my diet is bad. And the epigenetic question is also a factor. The environment does have an influence, and this can appear in families. If you've got a child who's donor-conceived, comes into the world in a family which is quite structured, where you have material and emotional security, all of this which is assured before your birth, and when you were informed then of how you were conceived, as they did with me and my brother, and at the time the medics didn't encourage the family to tell the children, I was lucky I was told quite early, and I had to kind of digest this and come to terms with it. And I would also point out that for donor-conceived people, their history cannot be compared to adopted children or children who are handed in, you know, and the mother doesn't even leave her name. Because there's a mother always there. There's no abandonment ever. We were never abandoned by anyone. There's no wound associated with abandonment. Because adopted people will always think, oh, well, why did she abandon me? Or someone who was handed in to, say, a nunnery, why was I abandoned? But we were born, desired, loved, before we even were born. It would be difficult, it would take a long time to explain, but the donor's medical history is a false problem. Of course, maybe you could improve on things, probably ensure that all the data are kept. But that's another issue. Now, another point was the risk of consanguinity. This is, again, a question which I feel is laughable, because people hold this up as a truth, and yet they've never asked how many, even people in this room say, are people who have come from adulterous relations, which means that, I mean, the doctors have collected some data on this. You present this as people who go blindly into a technique and the children are paying the price of all this now. Well, in France, you have 3-4% of children who are the fruit of adulterous relations. So that means that you have more risk than I do of encountering your half-brother, half-sister, whereas I am protected from that because the number of children who can be born from one single donor has been restricted. So here again, we're told about this risk of consanguinity. Well, fine, but I really think we have to cast aside all these blind things of faith and look at the facts. Look at the facts instead. When it comes to when you tell the child and how, well, of course, today the sperm banks have changed the way they work. Back then, society wasn't ready. This was there was stigma attached to it. So you could try and act as if it hadn't happened, because you would take a donor who might be roughly physically similar to the infertile parent. So you could not mention it. But then we realized that where the children were told very late, they tended to demand that, to know who their father was, the donor was. Now, there are many reasons to ask for anonymity to be lifted. There are three cases in the association, indeed. These are three cases where it was a sperm donor. In two of the three families, you had a father who left virtually after the birth of the child, and in the two other cases, the father died. So those people want anonymity to be waived, and they see the donor as a kind of substitute father. Now, we, as donor-conceived people, can construct all sorts of fantasies about our fathers. I have studied mathematics, and I thought, oh, my donor must be good at mathematics. But maybe not. It could have been my mother. So you can imagine all sorts of great things about your father. Because you have total ignorance, you can project things onto that donor. But you also have the right to project that. I mean, everyone's, you know, I wish I had a better mother or a better father. So you're trying to get rid of injustice, but this is my pacemaker card. I'm not complaining about this because it didn't come from my donor. And these are things which happen when you inform. You asked about the 70,000. 70,000, that's just for the French figure. So of the 70,000 children, we don't know how many know about how they were conceived. I see couples and parents who are very concerned about how to tell the child that it was donor-conceived. Is it up to the law to tell the parents how to do that? Now, in France, you're supposed to specify, well, there was a question, something which is suggested that this should actually be put on the identity card. But if you start saying that on the ID card, you should perhaps put the sexual preference on and the religion and so on. And if you are going to dictate that the children are told, well, shouldn't you also inform your child if they're a product of an adulterous relationship? Why would you stop there? Why would you just pick on the donor-conceived people? This kind of adulterous thing might affect lots of families. So I don't think it's useful to regulate this kind of thing, to force parents to
tell children how they were conceived. Most of them have understood, and they could be guided. A psychologist was talking there. It's good to tell the child in serene circumstances, at a calm time. The way you tell them is important. You should both agree to tell them, because sometimes only one parent wants to tell the children and not the other. So you have to work together to decide how to do it. You can't rush into it as to how you tell the child. There has to be a gentle approach to this. If the parents are fine about it and they have got over the bereavement of not being able to conceive naturally, then they should be able to convey that. And there are also considerations of general interest. You will have heard Dr. Rose's presentation. I would point out that in France, we are more of a secular country, and we have this idea of the common good. And I think this is an example of what happens in a country where common law and the individual prevail. Now, I would be prepared to sacrifice certain things in the name of the common good rather than looking only at my personal interest. What we saw there, that situation, which was very complicated, when she talked to us about a donor-conceived person in Australia who was looking for her father, well, again, I was thinking, hang on, hasn't she already got a father? That means that if she needed to find the donor, was the other father missing? You'd have to know all the details, and all this is to do with the work of psychologists, really, to see what is to do with anonymity or what is not to do with anonymity, the other factors involved in that person's history.
To interrupt, because it's a little bit unpolite for the hosting parliament to let them wait so long for our coffee break, because the coffee is finished outside. I will now make a break, because they are waiting since a half hour that we are coming. And then we come back, 10 minutes break. And Christoph, I can give you... Yeah, after the coffee, you come back and you can speak. And Christoph, this has nothing, mathematics and genius has nothing to do together. I'm completely a stupid man regarding mathematics, but my son loves mathematics. And sometimes I tell him, you are not my son. So I think there is no direct line. So please take the seat that we can continue. In the break, I had a debate with some of you, and maybe I put the question from the break, but I must say it in German, because we are the social committee, so sollten wir uns auch.
Should we perhaps also turn to this subject of payments and heritage, basically inheritance and alimony payments? Should we think about that?
Came in contact with all his 19 children. He will be poor and not able anymore to go to Uzbekistan or like where else. When it's for work, okay. But I told Martin or somebody else that I know a famous singer in Germany, and his tax managerin asked him for a donation of sperm, because she thought, what Philip thought, that when she gets sperm from a famous singer, that the daughter will be a prima first soprano at the opera. But meanwhile, he's not anymore living in Germany, because the last 4 years he spent in front of the court. And because this woman asked for everything, for pay for the children, pay for herself, and. And now he moved to Belgium, and he asked that he can see his child. But she was successful in the court in Germany, that is not possible for him. Then he moved to the court in Belgium, and the Belgium court gave him right. Yes, you have the right to see your child. It's interesting. We are in one Europe, and so we have different decisions. Okay, but let's come back. Who wants to continue now? You? Yes? Please.
Bom, este assunto, penso que...
This subject, I think, unites us in one sense. It's a very interesting subject. It's very motivating. It's a very emotional and very delicate. We must not discuss anonymity or the lack thereof with preconceived ideas, with any form of fundamentalism, and without a deep understanding of what we are discussing. Today, we had two outstanding contributions from Christoph and from Ruth. They were completely different from two different viewpoints, but they were equally valid and important for MPs to hear. And it's important for you as MPs to think about those. And the best way to provide a balanced report that you are due to produce. We have had some very emotional presentations. It's for MEPs and the Council for Medically Assisted, Assisted Reproductive Technology to produce a report, but in a balanced way. A number of questions were raised. Portuguese law, up until the decision of the Constitutional Court, was to a degree balanced. Some of the questions which have been raised here or at least some of the problems that have been raised here didn't exist in Portuguese law. the question of genetic illnesses that might be transmitted. Portuguese law enabled one to know the genetic identity of the donor. Only, it didn't allow that, only, it didn't allow the civil identity to be known. The Constitutional Court now permits the knowledge of civil identity. And under Portuguese law, it was possible to have to raise a confidentiality in a court case where very weighty reasons were proved in court. Now, our law in this on this subject is relatively recent. It dates from 2006. Now, the Portuguese situation and what's in question now, at question now, is not to discuss whether there should be anonymity or not. The Constitutional Court was very clear on that. The question is how we are going to carry out the transition from one paradigm to another, and how, from now onwards, one can gain access to this identity. And it's that that the Portuguese Parliament has to decide now, and it has to provide law on that. It has to regulate that. Who can have access to that information? Only the person who was born. Can the person who was born publicly disseminate that information? At what age can they have access to that information? That question has been raised. We've talked about this in the council, and we believe that only when the person is of age, which in Portugal is 18 years of age, we have to decide as well what are the obligations and the rights of the person who is born when they have that information, whether they can disseminate that information, whether they can or not contact the donor, whether they can contact the donor's family. There is a whole raft of questions which have to be decided upon and regulated by the lawmakers here in this country, because we are discussing all of the rights here, the individual's rights, the donor's rights, the parent's rights, and we have to regulate how a person can gain access to the information and what the person can do with that information. So I think there's no doubt that in Portugal, we no longer have donor anonymity. It's a new paradigm. But now donors and couples or women who ask for a gamete donation, they now understand that anonymity no longer exists. They know the rules of the game now. Donors and parents who were parents and donors before didn't know that. And so the rights of those parents and donors have to be the subject of special attention by the Parliament, and they have to be very carefully pondered. To end, this issue is being discussed in Portugal, but it is also being debated by experts and specialists behind closed doors in the university halls. I want to see, and the council wants to see, the board wants to see, that this discussion take place in the public domain as well. Because we're talking about a major change of paradigm. We're talking about a change in attitude. And we know that ART, especially with the donation of a gamete, is something that is going to have to be discussed. In a country which is known for its secretism, people don't talk about these things. Parents don't talk to their children about this type of situation. They don't even discuss these issues with their closest family members. They don't even think about how they might talk about this to society in general. So we need a complete change of mentality. The Council for ART really has to look at this issue, and we hope that the conditions will be in place next year. And in fact, this is part of our plan of activity. Next year, we hope that we can launch a public symposium open to the public and not just specialists. That includes the universities, schools, etc., so that people can discuss and go into further depth on these subjects, so that when we deal with these subjects, we are not going to deal with them via superficial passion, if you like, but we are going to understand the underlying issues. Thank you very much.
Carla Maria. Now I want to inform you that you not be nervous. The buses are coming at 6:30, so I hope we can now work 1 hour to finish our agenda from the afternoon. And Carla Maria, maybe from my country, Austria, I can tell you that the Constitutional Court took a decision 2006-2007. That everything has to go from the point of the view of the child. Because there was a very famous singer, he produced a child after a concert, and he did not want to see. But this girl moved to the court and said, I want to have the right to be in contact with my father. And then they took a principal decision that when a child wants to do that, it everybody has to do, and the family has to follow the wishes of the child. Maybe you need something else in the Portuguese legislation. Now we have to move on, and now I give the floor to Miguel. Yes, it's okay?
Thank you so much. Vou falar em português.
I'll speak Portuguese slowly. To help the interpreters and to try to respond to some of the questions which have been asked of me. The essential point for me is not our choices or our emotions. The essential question, as Carla Rodriguez said, is to understand ourselves. Know ourselves, and to know ourselves as children, as adolescents, as young adults, as children who were born of donors, want to know. Those 70,000 people in France that were born through donor conception, I don't know whether that particular question has been studied. No, it doesn't matter what I think or anybody else here. It's what the children themselves think that matters. Children who were born of donor conception. If no studies have been carried out for that, either it's because nobody's had the courage to carry out such a study, which tells you a lot in itself, or they didn't want to for some other reason. In Portugal, the Reproductive Medicine Authority carried out such a study over 11 years. In fact, for 11 years, people didn't want to, didn't want to carry out this question. And those same people who were there for 11 years are going to be there for 16 years. And the reason that they don't want this study carried out is for their own interest, because there are vested interests in this. Now, what do I think about retrospective implementation? I would say definitely not. Those who donated sperm and eggs up until 2018 did so anonymously, and that right has to be respected. Unlike what happened in Australia, in the state of Victoria, and I don't agree with this, but in Victoria, the anonymity was lifted retrospectively. In Portugal, no, I don't agree with that. We screen donors here in Portugal. Theoretically, they're healthy. But there are illnesses that we don't understand today, but they arise tomorrow or next month or next year. So nobody can guarantee that the donor is healthy. That person is healthy today, according to the state of scientific knowledge today, and that's important. Whether you should tell children or not, well, all the studies that have been carried out, whether in the UK by the Nuffield Council on Diabetics or in Northern Europe, where they went out to try and find out what children wanted, the vast majority of children want the right to know. The right to know is not the duty to know. The right to know is not the duty to know. It is the right to exercise that power if they want to. So when you say, at what age should we reveal to a child that he or she has been conceived via donor conception, the vast majority of studies would say as early as possible. Most studies clearly state that there's no magic age. 18, that could be very early, it might be very late. 16, might be very early, might be very late. From a bioethic viewpoint, we always say that age in itself is not an ethical criterion, and we are discussing an ethical criterion. Two young people of 16 years of age are not ethically the same. They don't have the same maturity, perception, intellectual development, etc. And so, no, whether that should be imposed by law that says 18, 16, 17, etc. To respond to the question of the MP... to my right, that map only represents people from the European Union, not the 47 countries of the European Council of Europe. I know that the Council of Europe has 47 member states, the European Union has 27, 28. We shall see. And a final observation. If I understood my colleague here to my right, it was stated here, at least I understood, and possibly badly, and I hope badly, that he said that statistically, children knowing that they are donor conceived have lower possibility or probability to have a genetic cancer. Did I understand that well, or did I understand that wrongly? If I understood wrongly, I apologise. If I understood, I will only say that I've never seen such a study, and I would like to know where I can find one. Thank you very much.
Okay, and finally, where's Madame Rose?
She left.
Oh, she left. Yes. Then finally, Petra. For the closing remarks.
Yes, thank you very much, Chair, and then the experts on the panel. Thank you very much. I rarely have seen a debate in the Council of Europe that took almost 3 hours. So this means the subject is really very important, very complex, difficult. And I've been reading a lot of literature on the subject. Usually, if you read papers, you always have them go in one direction or another, because they observe, they interpret, or they have preconceived ideas that they prove or disprove. This report will really, I guess, be a very complex report taking all the arguments that we have heard in all the aspects that we have been discussing. So I just hope that I will be able to come back to you in the committee probably in December with a report that goes in a certain direction. After what I heard today, it's not going to be easy to find consensus or one common conclusion for the report. And I guess we will take the human rights approach, we will take the child's approach in balancing the rights of donors and families. And with three parties, it's not going to be easy. And I'm not going to conclude anything today on the content of how we will proceed, but I want to thank all of you for your expert interventions and also for the debate from my fellow parliamentarians. Thank you very much, and I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I will leave today with more questions than answers in certain regards, but hopefully we'll be able to put some answers in the report. Thank you, Chair.
Yes, now, finally, as chair of this committee, I want to really thank to our great experts. Really, it was impressive, and you see, the follow was a very lively debate. And I thank all to you who took the floor and debated in that case. And for you, Carla, all the best in Portugal. I think you have to move stones away. It's not so easy, but maybe Edita and Luis will help you inside the Portuguese Parliament. And yes, and last but not least, I want to say thank you to Petra, because Petra is the guarantee for interesting thematics in the social committee, which are always on a way to be debated, which touch everybody in his soul. And that I had the feeling today that everybody who asked for the floor and all our experts was touched by this thematic. And Christoph, to you as a young man, I want to say I have deeply respect from your position, and that you are acting in that way as you are doing. And it is not usual to speak so open as you did. And I have really great respect. And I wish you and your movement or your union all the best. And I hope with Petra's resolution we can support that what you are doing with all the others together. Thank you very much. Dear colleagues, now we are coming to the other part of life, to the palliative care. And yes, you are leaving. I say thank you, but sorry that I move on. And I'm looking now up to Rona, and I ask you something. Are you able to make an introduction only with 5 sentences? Yes? Great. Okay, you get 1 sentence more. 6, okay? Please try, because we have to vote paragraph by paragraph. Thank you very much for being
here. Thank you, Chair. Well, I'd like to add my word of congratulations on that previous debate. Normally, such long debates, you might lose the will to live, but that certainly didn't happen there. Okay, brief introduction. Friends, following on from previous meetings, there were some areas that we were asked to cover and that I'm very happy to say are addressed in my report. For example, we were asked to consider the issue of children and their particular palliative care needs. We don't go into that in detail. It merits perhaps it's different and separate treatment, but we do address some of the core issues. Issues like palliative sedation were raised previously. I think it was Petra who raised it, and that's mentioned in the report. And we've also added consideration of the gender dimension of the report. The role of informal caregivers is something as well that we pay a bit more attention to, recognising that there's a spectrum here, really, that cure and the need for cure is very often what perhaps prevents a greater understanding of palliative care needs and what needs to be addressed. So we can think in terms of moving from a cure to care spectrum and integrating care for the person, including palliative care, as necessary in the healthcare system. Very often healthcare systems, by overemphasising cure and treatment, perhaps fail to recognise sufficiently early the need for palliative care. So we have a draft resolution then that starts from the point of view that palliative care is fundamental to human dignity and should be a component of the human right to health. And we encourage member states to see a palliative care provision as a human right, as something to be incorporated as a matter of human rights into healthcare systems. To look at making it more accessible across socioeconomic and regional divides. To extend the provision of palliative care into areas beyond the traditional area of cancer sufferers. And to provide palliative care in a way that is holistic, addressing people's psychosocial, physical and spiritual needs. Recognising the importance of training, whether it's training healthcare professionals to understand the importance of opioid-based treatments, necessary in particular, obviously, for the management of pain relief, to training about the need to address palliative care and to have courage in addressing palliative care needs early on in the treatment of persons, not just with terminal illness, but with chronic illness or other life-limiting conditions as early as possible. The need to alleviate fears, both among patients, among families, but also among medical professionals who might be unaware or hesitant to introduce the topic of palliative care. To deliver palliative care contemporaneously with treatment of disease and illness is important if we are going to get that early intervention that's so important. Recognising that quality palliative care saves on healthcare costs in the long run and doesn't, in addition to meeting the obligation to human dignity that is involved at so many levels. Working closely with the voluntary sector who have contributed so much to the development of best practice in palliative care. And finally, caring for the carer, not just addressing the needs of the patient, for example, in the provision of home and community-based care, but recognising that the carer too needs care to help them care, but also to help them cope psychologically and emotionally in terms of what their patient is suffering, their loved one is suffering, and the needs that they themselves have. Not six sentences, but that's
only
it.
One. I want to ask, when you promise five sentences, how long we stay?
But you have to count the full stops, Stefan.
No, Ronan, I only want to say we have no general debate today. We have to finish your report by voting, and your report will be in the standing committee in Helsinki.
Very good.
And for that we have to finish now the report. Dear colleagues, if nobody asks for the floor, I want to move for the voting. Okay. Is it okay? Okay. Paragraph 1. Are there any abstentions or anybody against? No. Paragraph 2. I can't declare it is adopted. Paragraph 3. I adopt it unanimously. Paragraph 4. Also unanimously adopted. Paragraph 5. I see no abstentions. I see no contra, so I can declare it also as unanimously adopted. Paragraph 6. I'm looking around. No interventions. Unanimously adopted. Paragraph 7. Thank you. Also unanimously adopted. 7.1. No interventions, unanimously adopted. 7.2. Thank you. The same, unanimously adopted. No interventions. 7.3. Same, adopted. 7.3.1. Adopted. 7.3.2. No interventions. Thank you. Is adopted. 7.4. No interventions. Adopted. 7.4.1. No interventions. Adopted. 7.4.2. So is also adopted. 7.5. Adopted. 7.5.1. Adopted. 7.5.2. No interventions, unanimously adopted. 7.6. No intervention, adopted. 7.7. No intervention, adopted. 7.8. Adopted. 7.9. No intervention, adopted. And finally, like the further report, paragraph 8, adopted. Thank you. Now we have to vote for the report in whole, and therefore I ask you to show your hands. Who is in favor of the Ronan report, palliative care? Is anybody against? Nobody. You are against? No. Anybody against? Any abstentions? Congratulations, Ronan. Unanimously, what is with you? Is this an Irish match, or what is this now?
Yes. Can I make a brief remark? Can I make a brief remark?
You want to say something about this nice gentleman?
About the report, yes.
Okay.
A very brief remark. If I could make a brief remark, I would like to congratulate my colleague, Senator Ronan Mullen, on the excellent report, and I know firsthand from working with him in the Irish Parliament that he's been working on this for a long, long time, put a huge commitment into it, and as leader of the Irish delegation, I'm very proud of that and proud of what he's done, and it's a very pertinent report. I suppose, are we allowed to ask him questions? Can I ask him a question? No? Are questions allowed? No.
Question to Ronan?
Yeah, can I ask him questions about it? No. Can we make a comment? But if I were to have an opportunity to ask a question, the question I would like to address to him is the question of opiates are needed in the treatment of people in palliative care, and yet they present difficulties with addiction, particularly notably in the US and a number of countries. We have issues with addiction with opiates, yet they're needed in the treatment in palliative care. And would he comment on the reconciliation of those two things, and has he thought about that in the context of his report? Otherwise, I just want to congratulate him on the report.
Okay, wait 1 minute. Stella, ask also for the phone.
First of all, I wanted to thank Mr. Mullen for tackling such a difficult subject in such a sensitive and balanced way, and I think that was evident from the way that this has been adopted, and I wanted to thank you for it. It has not been easy, and I know. Mr. Shenak, Stefan, we took 3 hours for the previous report, and we raced through this. And I don't know if this is procedurally correct. Tanya, I'm sure, will say it's not. But as we were rushing through, I was trying to get someone's attention to add a word in. I know that we've adopted, but I think that it's very important that we have in the draft resolution just a specific reference also, as you have put in your memorandum, sir, on children. So I would just like, where we speak on, in view of the above, the Assembly calls on the Council of 7, paragraph 7, Council of Europe Member States to take the following measures with a view of strengthening palliative care services and to assuring access to quality palliative care, instead for everyone, for both adults and children who need it. Because then you put children into this in terms of specialized services, etc. Thank you.
I think, Doreen, you want to speak in favor of that.
Yes, here we go. Thank you, Chair. Yes, I entirely agree with that, of course, that children should be. I had thought it was in the first part, but it actually isn't. It's in later on. Thank you, Ronan, for this report. Very well done, and I'm glad it's come out so balanced and so well. Just two brief things. One is, we did discuss earlier on the issue of funding for hospices, and I think there's a real tension here, maybe not in all countries, but certainly in the UK, as we know, for hospices the money for patients does not follow the patient as it does in the NHS clinics. So hospices had to fundraise to keep open, and I think that's an issue that is really worth mentioning, because they have a hard time sometimes. They do wonderful jobs, as we all know, but they are certainly sometimes very lacking in money, because the money doesn't follow the patient. That's one thing. And in paragraph 46 of the report itself, the main body of the report, you're talking about spiritual need, and I would like the word, you've talked about different faiths and you've talked about denominations, I would actually like the word faiths and beliefs in that.
Sorry, which paragraph you are speaking?
I'm in paragraph 46 on page 13, the second line down of the memorandum, yes.
In the memorandum?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Yes. At the moment, we touched not the memorandum.
Oh, okay,
yeah?
Okay. Well, can we bear it in mind then?
At the end, I only say we take the memorandum
as it stands. Yes, right.
I have now only one problem. I think Ronan agree into the position of Stella, yeah? Which is supported by Doreen too. Yeah? So we voted before for this paragraph. So if nobody makes now an intervention against what I make a proposal, that we vote again about the paragraph 7 with the new wording, if Ronan accepted. Can you all accept that we take this new wording? Then please, now we must be correct, because we go back in the voting period. Is anybody against this?
Adding the word children.
Sorry?
Adding the word children.
Yeah, is in the second line, in the third line of paragraph 7. Then we add these two words, and that everything is correct, then it's unanimously adopted. Yeah? So
did anybody see the movie Back to the Future? We're going back to address the defect.
No, we go only back to 7 and nothing else. And now we have amended report. So now my question is, who is voting for the amended report now? Okay. For the memorandum, we heard the wish from Doreen. This is in your hand. Yeah? Any abstentions for this report? Anybody against? So now the amended report is now unanimously adopted. Congratulations. And I will underline the words of your colleague from the Irish Parliament, from Stella, that was, I was really impressed in this half year how a young man works so sensitive on this palliative care. And that was really impressive. And Ronan, congratulate. And I think this committee shows his full respect for your work, that this report is now unanimously presented. In Helsinki, everybody of you who is in the standing committee has the chance to repeat this voting, so that also in the standing committee you get an unanimously adoption. Now the floor is yours.
Thank you, Stefan. Well, could I start by thanking you for your very kind words just now, and for my distinguished colleague as well, Senator Joe, my friend and colleague Joe O'Reilly, and of course to Stella and Doreen, who have been so good, as others have been, Petra and others who not here, who contributed on previous occasions as we deliberated on this. I'm very, very grateful to you for your support for this report, and indeed for your excellent suggestions, and all of them I'm, as I've just seen, very happy to take on board, and delighted to incorporate that comment as well, Doreen. It would be remiss of me as well not to thank the Secretariat, and particular Aishgul Elviris, for her excellent work in this. It's been a great pleasure to work with her on that, and we all know just how crucial and crucially supportive the Secretariat is to our work. So thank you so much, Aishgul, and for your help and your professionalism all the way through. And Joe had a quick comment in response to Joe's question about opioids, as I try to make clear in the report. This is an area which sadly isn't resolved, in that there are instances, even in our Council of Europe member states, where access to pain relief simply isn't what it should be. And the Lancet, indeed, as we cited the report, identified a number of the issues holding back quality palliative care in the area of pain management, and there can be a phenomenon of opiophobia, where people don't realise the impact, the positive impact of the appropriate use of opioids in the treatment of pain. There can, of course, be an influence as well from the very understandable need to fight the non-medical use of controlled substances, which is a factor in all of that as well. But it's a question of balance and education to recognise, yes, there are risks, as we've seen in places like America, around the use of opioids, but the appropriate use is something that must always be strongly promoted, and fears addressed in that area. And indeed, progress is being made in states in that area. So that's really all I have to say, but just to thank everybody again for their support for the report and for their kind comments just now.
Thank you, Ronan, again. And John, be prepared a motion before you asked about involuntary addiction to prescription medicines. The reason is, as the chair of this committee, I was generous in the bureau meeting, and I said, we don't need to report about drugs in the committee, because in the history, all the drugs report was made in the social committee. But I said, okay, the chair, Suna Evastotter, brought it in, so this committee should make, and we make the opinion. I know this was a little bit generous, but in the tradition of our committee, we don't want to go back by track reports, law and order, and anything else. And so we prepared this motion, and I think it's exactly on the point, and maybe Ronan is a candidate for this report. We will see. Anybody of us will be the candidate for this report. Yes? So in that way, thank you. Now I have to move on. It is 6:10. The next is the Subcommittee of Public Health and Sustainable Development. This committee worked today in the morning, and I ask Martin Mergen to give us a short report.
Oui, merci, le président. Merci.
Thank you very much, Chairman. I presume that all those who are present now were present at the subcommittee meeting this morning. Is that the case? Is everyone here now also, were they present this morning? In which case, I can be very brief. We approved the necessary things and had an exchange of views on the concept of the global kidney exchange, and we adopted a declaration, a committee statement presented this morning, and we would like to hand this over to the Social Affairs Committee for the follow-up. Thank you.
Merci, Martin. Can we agree in the draft declaration about kidney, which came from the subcommittee? I see nobody is against, so I can tell it we agree, and the declaration is adopted. Now I move to Doreen, Subcommittee on Children, and I want to give you the floor for the meeting of the subcommittee this morning.
Oh, thank you. Wonderful, wonderful. Thank you. Thank you, Stefan. We had a meeting this morning of the Children's Subcommittee on Children of this committee, and I'd like to thank the committee for their keenness and dedication in developing issues on children in their own countries. We had three main agenda items. We had, first of all, we talked about activities in different countries, and what came up was the developments in mental health in relation to bullying in the Netherlands from Reiner. We talked about migration, and Stefan, you raised a point about having a resolution, a statement from the Children's Committee, but we can't do that because it has to be this committee. So we're going to work on this, get some evidence, and talk to the Migration Committee about putting out a statement. Is that right, Stefan? Tanya's nodding, so it must be right. And then I mentioned the follow-up to the seminar in London on child mental health and child-friendly justice. I said that we were having now roundtables with ministers to keep up the momentum there. We have coming up on the 17th, 18th of October a joint meeting of the Subcommittee on Education, Youth and Sport with ourselves in Tbilisi, Georgia, which will be on the child protection, child against child violence and child sexual exploitation in sport. And we shall be, that'll be over 2 days, we'll have presentations and then a workshop which will pull out a statement or declaration on the violence against children in sport. Very important issue, and I'm sure we shall be able to report back to you in a very interesting way. The final thing was that I did mention that I'd been talking to colleagues about the involvement of young people in the Council of Europe, and there was some enthusiasm there. The president of PACE, Liliane, has said she would be keen to meet with a small group of people to look at how this might be taken forward, together with the committee, not the committee, the Centre for Youth in Strasbourg and the Children's Rights Division. So if anyone is interested in joining that, Stella's also joining. Was it you, Martine? Did you say you would want to join that? The meeting with Leanne?
Yes, the Leanne. Martine said following the elections, if all okay, she will join.
Is that right?
Yes.
Yes, okay. So with there are two volunteers. If there are others, please tell me. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Doreen. Now, we have the quorum, and we have to make two decisions. The first decision, we need the appointment of a rapporteur for the report from our President of the Assembly, Maury Pasquier, Organ Transplant Tourism. I know that Stella is very interested into this report. Can we nominate Stella for this? Is there any other candidate? If not, then we can. Then Stella Kyriakides is appointed as a rapporteur for organ transplant tourism. Have you any conflict?
No, I have no conflict.
Thank you. We notice. Is Mr. Badea still in the room? No. He should also make a declaration of no conflict. Now we come to the last item. First, I want to tell you we have no changes in the subcommittees. Yeah? No changes. No.
Possibly one.
Possibly one, but they can be done. But now we have to make a draft motion for a resolution. And Martin Mergen, you have again the floor. The story in front of this motion is long, and we had a lot of meetings with representatives from Turkey, with the civil society, with the government, with experts. And in the last meeting, I told you it comes to an end, these informal meetings, and we make a really good motion, and a motion for report, and I ask you to introduce into this motion.
Oui, merci beaucoup, Président.
En fait, thank you very much, Chairman. Well, indeed, as Mr. Chenach has said already, we had quite a number of formal meetings and two informal meetings on this matter, and in the end, I think we all realised that this relates particularly to Turkey, but probably to other regions in our country. So it would be better to formalise the approach and propose a resolution, which I can briefly explain to you. There are 5 points. I think you have it. So to guarantee decent living conditions for the future and current generations, we need to look at the ecological processes and the ecosystems in nature. So there's the objective of sustainable development, SDGs, SDG 15, which says that we must ensure the sustainable exploitation of fresh water and so on. Now, we're constantly trying to achieve a good performance, and natural resources that were protected sometimes get opened up to commercial interests, and this can lead to a clash with environmentalists. So it's in the interest of all of us and the future generations and those involved in commerce to get together on this. There is a lot of concern, particularly in Turkey, and according to the civil society organizations, this project would open up the nature reserve to a lot of construction activity, and they say that no public consultation has happened. And this is regrettable, but unfortunately it's not peculiar to Turkey,
and requires a wider debate and taking urgent measures. How can we reconcile environmental protection and the rights of future generations to a healthy environment and the private market activities? So how can we achieve a balance on a case-by-case basis? How can we take into account the needs of local populations without throttling economic activity? And how can we use international principles to help our decision-making process? And the last point, sustainable development is a necessary prerequisite for human rights. Access to information and involvement in the decision-making process and access to justice, these are vital and they can help to find fair solutions. The Assembly has formulated various recommendations to ensure the use of soil in a responsible and inclusive way. So that's the draft resolution, which I suggest I can make into a full resolution and we can work on it in the future, in the near future.
Yeah, it's a human right to be involved in such process of decisions, which can change not only the life of the people who are living there, which can change the environment in one of the last coastal areas which are not destroyed by industrializing, tourism or anything else. And the problem is that there is no discussion with the civil society, with the NGO, with nobody. And what they are planning hurts the Barcelona Convention. And this is one of the things why we decided to make a recommendation. And the Turkish side agree that we are doing that. They understand our worries, our really worries. And we took it not from one shoulder to the other. We really debated hours with experts, with the civil society. And please, can we table now this motion and can go ahead? I think it is a good signal from Council of Europe to the NGOs, which are really under pressure there. Thank you very much. So we write in the minutes that it's unanimously agreed. Thank you very much. Now we come to the end of this working day. I want to thank you. I want to thank all those who helped us. I thank the Secretariat. I thank the interpreters for their excellent work. But I want to remind you that tomorrow it would be great if you can come to the cocktail in the Now South Center, that I am and Tanya are not completely alone. Second, Mrs. de Demmerman made such a good proposal to visit the first vessel, which is not, make note, the pollution of the sea. I know in Germany they have a big fight about that, especially in the north of Germany, with the cruising boats and what is going on there. And I hope that we are not three. I'm in favor to go with Mrs. Demmerman there, but maybe three is not a good figure.
The 12 so far.
Sorry?
The 12. More than for the reception.
Okay, but the reception, you know, the reception of the North-South Center is important. So wherever can find a possibility, come to this reception to the North-South Center. It's a part of Council of Europe and it would be great if you can find a possibility to take part. And now, the bus are coming in 5 minutes. We go now to Qashqais, amazing city, amazing. We pass Estoril. Those who love Formula 1 knows that they are going with the cars in the, around in Estoril. Is it right, Edita? Yes. and then you will see, you never will forget Qashqais. Have a nice evening together, and I hope all are coming to this invitation of the mayor of Qashqais.
For 5 minutes.